My guest today, Pedro Langa Shurion, is chair of the Department of Latina American Studies at the University of San Francisco, specializing in Latin American contemporary narrative and critical theory. His academic areas of specialization include Latin American literature and culture, film studies, urban studies, comparative literature, and critical theory, particularly psychoanalytic theory. He has co-authored and co-edited Postmodernity in Latin America, a reader published by Humanity Books in 2001, an article in which was singled out as an important contribution in understanding the neo-Baroque aesthetic in Latin America and its relation to the global discourse on postmodernity. Professor Langa Shurion has also written and directed a number of films, one of which, Visitas, that explores the violence in neighboring Colombia, was an official selection in 8 international festivals in Canada, the U.S., and Cartagena. He's also native of Venezuela, where his parents still reside. We last spoke in October, where the Venezuelan economy was already deep into free fall and the political system with it. Well, good morning, Pedro. It's my pleasure to welcome you again to Takes on the World.
Good morning, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
There was a number of aspects of the Venezuelan crisis I'd like to discuss with you today, but let's begin with a story in today's New York Times noting that the a government panel had cleared the way for a process to get rid of President Nicolas Maduro, to oust him. Mm-hmm. How significant is this?
Well, I mean, that's very significant that the Electoral Council, the Electoral Panel, has cleared the way. There was some resistance at the beginning. There has been some resistance for quite a while now. I mean, this is a movement from the opposition to depose President Maduro that has been going for a while. But it's significant that they have gone ahead. Why is it significant? Well, because I think that there are divisions within the PSUV, that's the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, that Chavez founded, against President Maduro and against what he has done, you know, during his tenure as president of the country. So it's not usually what we hear, and what we hear from the left press here in the United States is that the opposition, which is usually wrongly characterized as a right-wing opposition, and that is not true at all. It's a coalition. I mean, the president of the assembly is the vice president of the Internacional Socialista, for instance. So they say that the opposition, which they wrongly, as I said, characterize as a right-wing opposition, wants to depose Maduro, and they characterize that initiative as an attempted coup d'etat. That is not true. The Constitution of Venezuela, drafted by Chavez and his team back in 1994, contemplates the possibility of revoking the mandate of the president if enough signatures are collected in the third year of presidency. And this is what is happening. That the Electoral Council or the Electoral Commission has given green light, I mean, that's super important. Why? Because the Electoral Commission is totally made up of Chavistas. So why have they done that when at the beginning they resisted it? And the only reason is I can think of is that there are deep-seated divisions within the Chavismo in order to depose Maduro, because it's a deeply unpopular president. So I think this is what's happening. And this is actually public. A few months ago, a number of a coalition of Venezuelan socialists, some of whom orchestrated the failed attempt to install Hugo Chavez as the nation's head of a state in 1992, wrote a letter. I mean, these are people that were with Chavez in the trenches during the attempted coup in 1992 when Chavez tried to depose then-incumbent President Carlos Andrés Pérez. They signed a letter and published a letter denouncing Maduro's presidency being abhorrent because what it has done to the country. Let me quote a part of that letter. It says, "The common citizen has become the victim of political and moral degeneration and its devastating effects. Personal and judicial insecurity, impunity, hyperinflation, unemployment, love of acquisition ability, hunger, poverty, and an extreme loss of quality of life. and the loss of the values it used to characterize our society. And this letter is signed by 12 people that were along with Chavez when the sort of revolution of the 21st century was initiated. Among them, Florencio Porras, Luis Eduardo Chacón, Ismael Pérez, Cira, Carlos Cuyón Celis, etc., etc., etc. So, as you can see, there are deep divisions within the Socialist Party, and the story is not as monolithic as the press characterizes it here in the United States when I read some articles that, frankly, are either deeply perverse or absolutely naive and puerile.
Well, there is a tendency that I've, in my many years of being a person of the left, in seeing what might be called a knee-jerk reaction to that mirrors the establishment, Washington establishment. I remember during the Vietnam War, for example, everything was blamed, whether from Central America to Vietnam, the Russians or the Chinese were behind every popular movement. And we on the left said the CIA was behind every movement within the Soviet Union or the East Bloc, and that there was that we both sides robbed the indigenous people, the actual people whose lives are affected by decisions in that country, from having any dignity and sense of saying that they want to make a change.
Yes, that's correct.
And I going into one article recently I read by someone named Eric Dreitzer, back east, who says Venezuela's opposition attacking its own people. And I go through this, and the economy, the corruption is put into parentheses, an important problem to be tackled, to be sure, he says. But let's talk about this, and this is what has brought one of the factors that's brought Venezuela to its knees.
Yeah, well, I mean, but this is what I'm saying. I would like to sort of dwell on, you know, the left response, and I am myself someone with left sympathies. But the kind of coverage they've given to the Venezuelan situation is absolutely naive. You know, on the one hand, they talked about an attempted coup from the opposition to depose President Chavez. Another article I read, I think it was published in the Havana or counterpunch.org, I can't remember exactly where, says that the opposition refused to grant Maduro executive powers to order by decree economic reforms. Now, of course, if you don't know the situation of corruption that the country leads, you know, you might think that the opposition is trying to sabotage the government. But when you realize that ministers of Chavez, like the Minister of Planification of Chavez, a communist known as El Monje, Jorge Giordani, resigned in 2014 after having been with Chavez throughout Chavez's whole tenure. And he resigned because $20 billion were unaccounted for. Well, he didn't resign. Maduro told him to go, but then he wrote a letter and totally resigned from any allegiance to Maduro and his people. $20 billion. Héctor Navarro, another minister of Chavez, Elisa Osorio, another deputy of the Par Latino, they all have come out and said that in a decade, there are $300 billion totally unaccounted for. So why would the assembly give executive power to an administration that has proven to be so corrupt, while the accomplishments of the Chavez revolution in terms of getting people out of poverty, which he did for a while, you know, have been totally destroyed. You know, there is even more than 80% of poverty index in Venezuela right now. So the economy has been absolutely catastrophic. It's the highest inflation in the world. So I would like to say to people that write from the left here in the United States particularly, you know, to ponder the fact that Venezuela during the Chavez years had unprecedented wealth because the barrel of oil was never as high as it was during the Chavez years. We never suffered an embargo like Cuba did. And yet, people are lining up in the streets to buy basic goods. I mean, to buy milk and to buy oil and to buy bread. They sleep on the sidewalks from 3 o'clock in the morning until the market opens. There's a deep scarcity and a deep economic crisis that is beginning to border on a humanitarian crisis.
In this article that I referred to, you would think that there is no scarcity. The writer, Dreitzer, writes, he says, a massive hoarding of basic consumer goods in warehouses owned by prominent Venezuelan business interests sheds added light to the lengths to which the right-wing opposition and elites will go to make their own country's economy scream. And what, obviously, if this was a fact, Maduro could order the army into opening these warehouses and showing the public all these hoarded goods, no?
Of course. I mean, let's not forget the fact that the main distributor of food in the country is a government. So, I mean, this is a total contradiction. I'm not saying there is no hoarding. I mean, there is hoarding everywhere. There was hoarding in Argentina, you know, in order to drive prices up. I mean, this is a lamentable sort of offspring or byproduct of market economy. But to justify the scarcity that Venezuela suffers of very basic goods on hoarding is absolutely absurd. Why don't they, for instance, mention the fact that during the Chavez years, 7,000 industries were expropriated or left the country? And I'm talking about Venezuelan industries. I'm not talking about transnational industries, which also left the country. You know, we had a very technologized dairy farm, that actually provided the central area of the country with milk and dairy. Now we have to import it from Uruguay, but Uruguay is not exporting it to Venezuela anymore because Venezuela has not paid their debt to them. Added to these, and the very, very basic problem that Venezuela is suffering is the fact that, you know, our main commodity, our only commodity, the commodity that accounts for 95% of our yearly income, the price of it has gone down because whatever, because Iran doesn't want to stop producing oil, because the world is flooded with oil, because there are alternative sources of energy. But you look at other countries in the world that are oil dependent, and they're not going through the same problem that of a scarcity and of hyperinflation, you know, projected to hit 3 digits this year that Venezuela is going through. So, I mean, it's the sort of account of what's going on in the country is extremely superficial and extremely naive.
What about the charges of drug smuggling?
I mean, that's something else, right? I mean, and this needs to be investigated. But how can you? You know, for a long time, there were not independent powers in the country. You know, the executive power and the legislative power and the judicial power were one and the same. It was all Chavista. Because of the election of December 6, 2015, a coalition in the opposition was able to you know, get enough votes to rule in the legislative power, which is the Venezuelan Assembly. But what the and I'll get to your question in a second, because it's very complicated. But what the press doesn't say is the fact that on the 30th of December of 2015, seeing the impending defeat that was coming, Maduro appointed 12 Supreme Court justices, by finger, all Chavistas. And he did that in order to invalidate what the assembly, whatever law the assembly formulated and tried to pass. So that's, in effect, you know, a coup d'etat to a political body, a legislative body elected by the people from Venezuela with a significant majority, right? So going back to your question, yes, I mean, there are charges of drug trafficking linked to officials in the government. But every time the assembly tries to investigate these charges, the Supreme Court of Justice in Venezuela, or the equivalent, which is absolutely controlled by Maduro, invalidates and undermines an investigation that the assembly recommends, or any law trying to investigate and settle what's going on in terms of drug trafficking in the country. You know, a few months back, two nephews, and this is how close to home it hits, two nephews of the current first lady of the country, who used the presidential ramp in the airport to take off, tried to smuggle 800 kilos of cocaine into the United States. They're in prison in New York. The press doesn't say that because the press is also control, you know, and there's no way there can be an investigation. Actually, some people think that the reason why Maduro is in power is not because he wants to be in power, but because he's forced or pressured by people who are, you know, knee deep in drug trafficking and people who are related to the government. They don't want him to go, because they fear what might happen to them.
It's interesting. This is a subject that, again, when people on progressive and the left discussing Venezuela, doesn't come up. And usually when something comes up, it's always like people have been framed as if corruption doesn't exist, is only a one-sided problem. Most governments have corruption to an amazing degree, and perhaps ours in the United States more than any other, but because we're so wealthy, well, people get away with it. We saw the revolving door between Wall Street and the arms industry in Washington is an example of corruption that would be grossly protested any place else in the world but the United States. But again, it's very one-sided. And even going back to this article that I mentioned before, it's like the writer says, the opposition and its U.S. patrons ceaselessly trumpet democracy and human rights while having no regard for either in Venezuela, from quite literally taking food from the mouths of Venezuelans to wantonly killing Chavistas and citizens alike. The opposition has proven itself to be just reactionary and anti-democratic but brazenly criminal. But this opposition won the election.
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy because you see it's kind of, what the article says are a bunch of generalizations, but there's nothing in that article substantial apart from these sort of pamphletary declarations about the U.S. imperial power and the U.S. Sort of imperial intervention in Latin America, which is true. I mean, during the 70s, it was horrible, as we know. I mean, Salvador Allende rings a bell, you know, to anyone who has read what has happened between the U.S. and Latin America in the 70s. But now the sort of pressure the United States exerts is different, right? It's economic pressure. Having said that, to this day, the first commercial partner of Venezuela is the United States, because we sell, you know, this is our first client. This is first, the United States is the first client of Venezuela. This is where we export most of the oil. So it is very paradoxical. It is not a revolution like the Cuban Revolution, you know, which caught, or the United States rather caught any sort of commercial dealings with Cuba that have been opening up now, as we know. Venezuela's first partner, commercial partner, is the U.S. So, you know, it's that kind of dichotomy or schizophrenia in the Chavista revolution. On the one hand, we have this very inflammatory leftist revolutionary discourse or rhetoric, but at the basis, structural basis of whom we do business with, you know, the country is still doing business with the U.S., right? So it's very strange what's going on in the country right now. And it's very worrying because we have, I think we have gotten to a point of no return in which something's got to happen. And Venezuelans, used to a subsidized economy, used to a form of wealth that is almost magical. You know, you put a drill through the ground and all this wealth comes out. Venezuelans psychologically are a bit impatient, right? And, you know, impatience, if you add to that impatience the fact that there are 6 million weapons in the streets of Venezuela, then the situation is very worrying. I think that what might be happening, and I'm talking about the pressure from the United Socialist Party in Venezuela to the Maduro government or for Maduro to resign, is that they might want to save Chavismo, you know, depose Maduro and have a more sympathetic, more benevolent, a less polarizing leader. That could be the vice president, Mr. Istúriz. We don't know that. But I think they want to transition and save Chavismo from a trauma that a civil war might ensue in the country.
Well, you brought
and I think that's yeah. why there is so much pressure from Chavistas themselves
you brought
to have Maduro
yes.
go.
As you brought up the situation with weapons and violence, even before the collapse of the economy, the amount of killings in Caracas, but in the country, were tremendous. I mean, much more than any other city or any other country in Latin America.
And in the world.
In the world. What was behind that, do you think?
Well, I mean, there are a number of factors. First, the social decomposition in the country. Then, after the attempted coup, after Chavez was giving a coup, I think he and his government became increasingly paranoid and afraid of another coup. And that was a coup orchestrated, partly, as we know, from the you know by the United States, Spain, and its allies. In that sense, Ms. Gollinger is right. I mean, she was able to trace...
Eva Gollinger you're speaking of, yes.
Yeah, Eva Gollinger, you know. As Chavez called her, the girlfriend of Venezuela. She was able to trace the number of NGOs operating in Venezuela to that coup. So that happened, okay? But since then, the Chavez government became very paranoid. And he wanted to sort of have a private army of citizens, which he called Bolivarian circles, and he armed them. This is what he did. Now, as the country became more narcotized, as it became more involved in drug trafficking, you know, these Bolivarian circles began to sort of run the business of drug trafficking within the country, both inside of the shanty towns and also in terms of exporting, using Venezuela as some kind of a port or platform to export drugs someplace else, drugs that mostly come from Colombia. I mean, they're not produced in Venezuela. So Chavez armed these people, and he was arming them for years. And what's ironic is that these very same people that the government armed, given the dire straits situation of the country, might be rebelling against the government. So, but yes, the index of crime in the country is worrying. It's almost like, I mean, the index of violence, it's almost like an undeclared war, if you think about it. We're talking about 25,000 people that are killed by guns every single year, right? I mean, that's astronomical.
And what's
in a country that is only 30 million people.
30 million people, yeah.
That's astronomical.
Of course, given the location of Venezuela, it would obviously be a target of narco-trafficking, and a temptation to get involved would be very high among government officials who would find the possibility of untold riches awaiting them around the corner if they looked the other way.
So, yeah, exactly. So if you sort of try to do a balance of the last 17 years, right? And if you use as a visual metaphor, the huge lines of people trying to buy goods, then you realize that the country has eroded, is collapsing, is nearing a humanitarian crisis, and then it becomes almost mathematically unthinkable when you think that the country never received as much money. It was flooded by oil money during the Chavez years. Flooded.
And mismanaged, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, how come we are where we are now? It's unthinkable. How come we are now in a country in which the government dictates 2 days of work a week? Because we have, an energy crisis that calls for electricity and water shortages all over the country. Why are we there? Yes, of course. I mean, there is a drought, and we're also a wonderful example of what, the depletion of the environment can do. But there are other countries in the region with a drought that are not going through what we're going through. We used to export electricity to Brazil. Now we have no electricity because we have not done in 17 years the proper maintenance to our docks and dams. So where has the money gone? And then when you have ministers, who worked with Chavez from the beginning, side by side, resigning and saying that there are, I'm not talking about 300 million. I'm talking, or 3 billion. I'm talking about $300 billion unaccounted for. $300 billion that have left the coffers of the country and left the coffers of the main industry, which is the oil industry, which, by the way, is bankrupt. Venezuela has to import oil from Brazil in order to meet its internal demands. Then, you realize in what kind of a situation we are.
And then in Brazil, of course, is a whole other form of catastrophe. And maybe you might have some thoughts on when we the attack and the efforts to depose the president, convict the president in Brazil, the return of a right-wing government in Argentina. Do you see this increasing turmoil in Latin America connected?
Yeah, I think it is connected. And perhaps it is connected for the wrong ways. If we look at Argentina, for instance, if we try to remember what Argentina was when Néstor Kirchner became the president of Argentina, it was a total mess. It was the shell of the country, right? Néstor and Cristina Kirchner were able to bring out of poverty millions of Argentina, who became middle class and then went ahead and voted against them, right? Argentina was hit by the economic crisis of Brazil, given that Brazil is its first commercial partner. But when Cristina Kirchner left, Argentina was still the second largest economy in Latin America. So what I'm trying to say is that it's very pernicious when we think about the left as one monolithic thing in Latin America. And I think it was a terrible mistake of these leftist governments in Latin America not to criticize or not to engage critically what was going on in Venezuela. Because then someone like Macri,
in Argentina,
in Argentina, who's you know, center right or perhaps more far right. You know, he criticizes Venezuela and he tells to the electorate, this is not where we want to go. Well, this is a job that should have been done by the left itself. So it's very easy for Macri to use Venezuela as an example of what shouldn't be done. You know, if Cristina Kirchner had done that, if Cristina Kirchner had criticized, you know, what was going on in Venezuela with Chavez and with Maduro, then I think something else would have happened. You can't compare what happened in Venezuela with the case with or the situation of Venezuela or with the leftist government of Evo Morales, which has been a successful government, you know, in many ways, with an inflation of, I mean, if you think that Venezuela's inflation is 700% and Bolivia's inflation is 3%, then you see a difference there. And you cannot even compare it to the situation in Brazil, right? Lula was able to bring out of poverty in a sustainable fashion 30 million people. So, but now we think about all these countries as if they were one and the same.
And he's being targeted now.
I think Lula is being targeted by a sinister right. In Brazil, and Dilma Rousseff. I mean, the way he was taken out of his house for questioning was sinister. It was like a symbol, right? Because he was taken not as a citizen who's cool, because he volunteered, but he was taken not as a citizen who goes to a police precinct for questioning. He was taken already as a prisoner, right? He was humiliated. So there is a targeting involved. And then the right-wing press manipulates the electorate and manipulates the people, and then there are protests for their impeachment. There are protests of a very vocal and mobilized sector of Brazil, you know, who are thankful for what Lula did and support him and are indignant about the way the right has treated him. So it's very unclear what they are charging Dilma Rousseff with, the crimes they are charging her with. It has to do with some corruption, Petrobras, but it's still unclear. But the media has already indicted them. So that's lamentable. But we cannot look at this region, and we cannot look at the leftist movements in this region as if they were, you know, cut this with the same knife in a monolithic way. You know, we have to nuance and compare and contrast. The project in Venezuela was a disaster. You can see it. Two-day work, a country that has become a major platform for drug trafficking in which, you know, members of officials in the government are deeply involved, a hyperinflation, rampant crime, you know, which gives us the dubious reputation of being the murder, Caracas being the murder capital of the world. Unprecedented corruption with $300 billion gone from the coffers and no accountability. This is what Venezuela is now, and a tremendous scarcity that is beginning to hit people where it hurts. You know, there's hunger in the country. There's no electricity. There's no water. And we're talking about the country with the largest oil reserves in the world.
And Pedro, that's where we're going to have to leave it until next time, and not a sad denouement ending to our conversation, but even sadder for the people of Venezuela. Pedro Langa Shuryan, thanks so much for being our guest today and Takes on the World and informing us about the situation from Venezuela with some new eyes on that. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Take care, Pedro. Bye-bye. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.